The creation of movies was an important cultural milestone, and with it came public fascination with the actors who appeared in them. Today, the obsession with celebrities has become a separate industry in itself, including sports, music, TV, and internet stars. Ty Burr, a film critic for the Boston Globe, explores the evolution of fame and celebrity status in his new book, Gods Like Us, on movie stardom and modern fame. It's published by Pantheon, and I'm very pleased that it has brought him to our show today. Hello.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Were you a fan before you became a film critic?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was a teenage movie geek. I got the bug when I saw Duck Soup late one night, you know, back in the 1970s. And I was just sucked into that strange world of black and white movies.
And then what about becoming starstruck as a fan, even though you wound up becoming a professional?
Absolutely. Like everybody else, you know, I'm drawn to these figures up there on the screen, and there's this mystery behind them, and they seem somehow better or more interesting, and you want to watch them and maybe emulate them and figure out what makes them tick.
Well, people have always, there have always been celebrities. How were celebrities treated before movies and television came along?
Well, they were localized. They were certainly stars of the stage in New York and elsewhere. I mean, in a way, you can almost point to somebody like Jenny Lind in the 19th century being toured around America as the first national, an early national star.
Or Dickens came.
Or Dickens, exactly. Or you could even look at a political figure like George Washington, you know. The movies were the first global delivery medium for fame.
And then early stars like Douglas Fairbanks and Mary Pickford became celebrities of a sort that are hard to imagine before. How was the treatment of them different than what we see today with Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie?
Well, it was new. It was freshly coined. There were no rules yet for how to behave around these people, about these people. You read about Pickford and Fairbanks after their marriage touring Europe, and they're surrounded by mobs. They open up their hotel rooms and there's people standing outside, you know, 10 people thick. And the culture sort of struggled with how to deal with this and what kind of value these people had. The arguments over Charlie Chaplin in the early days, who was a comedian, a lowbrow comedian, yet who had artistic qualities. That was a lowbrow, highbrow discussion that was really unusual in the culture.
How soon after the movies came along did the fan magazines appear?
Well, it's interesting. The fans were always lying in wait, even before the movie executives figured it out. In the very earliest days of film, the stars weren't credited. You go to see a movie, you know, one reeler, and you got the title and the company that made it. And so the fans started writing to the stars and to the companies saying, please tell us your name. It was the first secret.
But then the question occurs to one, why are the personal lives of stars so important to the public then and now? I mean, why do people care about the personal life of Tom Cruise or Kate Middleton?
Because it seems more, well, on one level, it just seems more glamorous and interesting, and they're pretty, to look at. On another level, if we're really drawn to a star, there's a mystery of identity there. And I think it comes down to the audience's uncertainty about their own identity. We always kind of want to know who we are. We're always uncertain. We're always doubting. And there are these larger-than-life figures who seem to have it together, who seem to have a coherent, organic personality. What is it? What's behind that?
And then they get divorced, or some paparazzi catches them in the nude.
Right.
And that brings them down to earth?
Well, it's another level of secret. And, you know, we're always interested in sort of peeling back the secrets. And, of course, that particular secret, that scandal, has become an entertainment field in its own right.
Well, today we don't have the studios controlling how publicity is done. But in the old days, the studios really wanted that kind of fan fascination. They just wanted to funnel it in and channel it in a way that didn't cause scandal.
Absolutely. It was a star factory. And one of the things I explore in my book, which is 100 years of the culture and how it changes and how technology changes the way we deal with famous people, is that control of star persona moved from the studios in the 30s and 40s. You have the breakdown of the studios, you know, in the post-war era. In the 80s, you get the agents taking control. These days, with the internet, the audience has control. We can repurpose Tom Cruise bouncing on Oprah's couch on the YouTube with, you know, a disco soundtrack or whatever.
Some of the stars seem more complicit than others.
Absolutely.
Some really work really hard to guard their privacy. But does that matter?
It depends. You know, we treat each star differently. We treat each star depending on how much we think they want to be watched. There are certain stars like Meryl Streep or Jodie Foster. We're not interested in their private life. We get the bargain we make for them, with them is that we get these terrific performances. There are other stars, and certainly with reality stars, these are people who want to be famous just because they want to be famous. And we engage with them while not giving them the respect we give to other people.
Then, in the early days, we had some scandals. The William Desmond Taylor scandal, right, which brought down Mary Miles Minter, among others, mm-hmm, and then the trial of Fatty Arbuckle. Did that alter the culture?
Oh, absolutely. The year was 1920, and there were three major scandals. Fatty Arbuckle, the murder of William Desmond Taylor, which still hasn't been solved, and Wallace Reid, who was the Tom Cruise of his day, the action hero, dying of complications of his morphine addiction. So you had sex, murder, and drugs on the table in a way that had never happened in Hollywood, and the audience... fans were both shocked, they were intrigued, and it really shook up the industry in a very big way, because up till then, fans had been sold this image that the stars were like you or I, just with more money and bigger cars and nicer houses. Now, all of a sudden, there was this element of dirt, and what other secrets could we find out?
Although in those days, it ruined Fatty Arbuckle's career, even though he may very well have been given a bum rap. Today, someone like Lindsay Lohan goes from problem to problem, and yet she still gets cast in movies and television shows.
No, she doesn't get cast in movies.
I just heard she was in another, she's going to do another film recently, or maybe she loses them ultimately. Britney Spears appears coming out of a car without underwear on. Her career isn't dead.
True, but we treat her differently and we treat Lohan differently than we treat somebody like Anne Hathaway, who is perceived to be a classy actress and can do nude scenes in a movie, yet we forgive her,
and
or
have a mobster boyfriend at one
point.
Right,
exactly. But because her persona involves classiness, craft, all these things, sweetness, we forgive her. Whereas if Lindsay Lohan does a nude scene in a movie, she's, you know, it would just fit the image that we have of her as this, you know, rebellious train wreck of a public personality.
But she was also a child star, so our first image of her was something quite different. She's betraying our sense of her as a pure little kid.
Oh, absolutely. And betraying in a weird way. And this is the problem with child stars, is when they grow up and if they go off the rails, they betray, they betray what we ask of them and what they promised, which is that they have this talent, but then they do something wrong with it, or they ignore it, or they don't. They mistreat our trust in them.
My guest is Ty Burr, who's been a film critic at the Boston Globe since 2002. Before that, he wrote about movies for Entertainment Weekly, a very different kind of publication. Now he's written a book called Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. It's published by Pantheon. Things changed with the advent of sound?
Oh, completely. That was the first renegotiation for the industry and fans alike as to what stardom meant, because all of a sudden you had a very, very vibrant, healthy movie factory and star culture, and all of a sudden their meaning of each individual star changed because they had to sound like who they were on screen. And what does a movie star sound like? The studios went crazy for about 5 years importing actors from Broadway. Maybe they had to sound, you know, have very good elocution. Eventually, fans and the industry figured out that stars had to sound like themselves. They had to have unique voices like Bette Davis or Jimmy Cagney. William Powell, who we all know and love from the Thin Man movies in the silent era, was a villain, was a heavy. And as soon as audiences could hear him, his persona totally changed.
On the other hand, Clara Bow, who had a really thick Brooklyn accent, pretty much saw her career ruined.
Well, she made movies. She made movies for about 2-3 years and threw in the towel for different reasons. Actually, I would argue that Clara Bow's accent sort of dovetailed with her persona as sort of a tough-talking Tootsie. Somebody like Norma Talmadge, who also had a New York accent but played grand divas, had a tougher time of it, and in fact tried to scrub it her accent away with elocution lessons, and was accused of critics as sounding first like an elocution student and then like an elocution teacher.
Have pop stars ever rivaled the movie stars, or did Elvis and the Beatles have to make movies before they could reach that top level?
No, absolutely. One of the things I talk about in the book is how in the post-war era, the culture changed and sort of the star-making dynamic shifted from the aging film industry first to TV, which brokered a whole new kind of star, smaller, more domestic, dressing, you know, Lucille Ball, who was a movie star in the 30s and 40s, on TV plays a housewife, a ditzy housewife who wants to be a star. Father Knows Best, all of these very small domestic figures where the star was really the character more than the actor. And pop music, with this burgeoning youth audience in the 50s and on into the 60s, created a completely new template for stars who were as valid for that generation as the movie stars were for their parents.
You dedicate a whole chapter to Marlon Brando. You call him the most exciting, baffling, charismatic actor in the history of cinema. How did he deal with, or how did he change Hollywood's concept of stardom?
Well, he was sort of the line in the sand, and he comes at the midpoint of the century of the history of them that I'm talking about. I talk a lot about in the book about how each generation sort of kills off its parents' stars and chooses new figures that seem more real, more relevant to who they are. And with Brando, that realism was very, very obvious in his bearing and in his speech, and most importantly, in the way he treated stardom. He rejected it.
In Sunset Boulevard, Gloria Swanson said, in the old days, the stars had faces. And you do have a feeling that the stars of the past, the 30s and the 40s especially, the Hedy Lamarrs, Rita Hayworths, et cetera, Ava Gardner, they were more beautiful than the stars today. Were they, or is it are we looking for people who look more like us today?
I think the culture goes back and forth, and it changes with generations. And you have periods where glamour is in, and we want gods, and you have periods where we look for something more relevant, more earthy, more real. So in the 60s, you have Dustin Hoffman starring in The Graduate, and the movie executives are saying to Mike Nichols, it's just a shame about the boy. And younger audiences look at him and say, yes, of course he's a movie star. And then 20 years later, Tom Cruise is the biggest actor in Hollywood, and the 80s are all about glamour resurgent.
What about the reality stars, the people who really haven't done much other than, like, Kim Kardashian? Kardashian? I never know how to pronounce her name.
Her name has become a shorthand. Her name has become shorthand for meaningless vessel of stardom.
Yeah, and I guess the most important thing she did was appear in a sex tape.
Well, that started it. And really, if you want to be one of these no-cal modern reality stars, yeah, you have to have a sex tape that gets everybody's attention. And then you go do a reality show where you keep your clothes on, and then you do the endorsements, and you appear on the cover of People.
And then you marry a basketball player,
right,
and divorce him immediately.
72 days. And there is a sort of accepted track. Do we treat these people differently than we treat, say, you know, George Clooney or Meryl Streep? I believe we do. I think we're willing to mock them, but at the same time, they're famous, so they must have value. And we do, I think, after 100 years, live dangerously in a culture of narcissism, where we look to these people and think, ooh, some people want to have what they have. Who cares if they don't do anything? They're famous.
Well, we have more ways to become famous.
Correct.
Today. In the past, it was movies and television. Now you can have a viral YouTube video and suddenly become a big star.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the clear through lines in the book is how technology slowly but inevitably brings the tools of celebrity, of making celebrity, to the audience themselves. So that these days, a teenager can do what only Mary Pickford could do 100 years ago, which is make a movie and have it seen around the planet, and they can do it in an afternoon.
Has celebrity changed the public's attitudes about minority groups? We have a lot of music stars from minority groups, and then, of course, there's Sidney Poitier, Denzel Washington, Halle Berry, who might not have achieved the kind of stardom they have today in the past?
It's a very good question. And you can argue that African-American stars can get marginalized into pop music. At the same time, you could argue certainly that Sidney Poitier, who was an incredibly important figure, was limited as an actor by the cultural expectations of what he had to be. I mean, he was the Jackie Robinson of movies. And arguably, you know, freed the way so that Denzel Washington and Will Smith and Jamie Foxx can be in movies now, and it's not about race unless the project calls for it and they want it to be.
Now, it's easy to make theories about why these people are so important to us, but do you have a theory?
Yes, I do. And it comes down to identity. I think we are uncertain of who we are. We wake up in the morning, we try on different, you know, clothes. We bounce ideas off our friends. We try on different social masks. We're uncertain. We're insecure. And one of the things about the internet now is that it allows us to put on those masks on Tumblr, on Facebook. You can be whoever you want to be in a way that we used to go to the movies to see what these masks, how would they would act in the world. What would happen if Betty Davis shot her lover? Would she be punished? Would she be rewarded? Would she get away with it? Now we can play those games ourselves.
And some people are complimented when they're told they look like a movie star.
Right.
Other people, it depends on who the movie star is, of course, whether you're complimented or not. Ty Burr will be giving a reading and signing books tonight at 7 o'clock at Book Court in Brooklyn on Court Street. His book is called Gods Like Us on Movie Stardom and Modern Fame. It is published by Pantheon. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.